such as a physician's report, that that treatment was for the work injury, but it turned out that it wasn't necessary to cure and relieve from the effects of the work injury, then the employer could be liable. It would be helpful, perhaps, to look at subsection 1 of 102.42 together with 1M, because a proper contextual plain language reading of 1M depends on looking at subsection 1. So under 102.42 sub 1, an employer must pay for an employee's medical expenses that were necessary to cure and relieve from the effects of the work injury. That's pretty straightforward. And there's no question that we're tying the treatment to the work injury in that situation. Now, as a narrow exception to this rule in 1, 1M is saying that if an employee goes in to get treatment for their work injury, but it turns out that that treatment wasn't necessary to cure and relieve from the effects of their injury, then the employer could be liable. But the implicit understanding is that the treatment is for the work injury rather than an unrelated pre-existing condition.
Who is supposed to make that decision? It looks to me like the employee listens to the doctors, and if the doctor recommends it, isn't that how this treatment occurred?
So the one who makes the decision about whether the treatment was related to the work injury is LIRC.
But you see, then you're putting the burden on an employee to know when a doctor recommends something that the treatment's not related to her work injury.
Right. I understand that that's a troubling implication, but The way the statute is supposed to work is if the treatment was related to the work injury, but the employee undertook it in good faith, they thought that they were getting treatment that was necessary, the employee could still recover under the statute. But the workers' compensation statutes are set up in this way where it's very common that after the fact, medical doctors come in and decide whether an employee's injury was actually work-related or whether it was a pre-existing condition that was unwork-related. And it's the same situation here, and this reading is very consistent with that framework.
What happens if the employee goes to the Mayo Clinic and visits with a surgeon and a general practitioner? How it works there is you see a general physician, and they refer you to a specialist, and then they might refer you to a surgeon, and you might be able to see all three in the same day, and all three of them say, yeah, it's related to this work injury,
mm-hmm.
and we can set it up to get this taken care of tomorrow or in a couple of days. And if you're the worker, you want to get back to work. I mean, you're not being, you may or may not be paid for your time away from work, not to mention the pain that you're going through. So if you have three physicians at the Mayo Clinic or any other highly reputable medical facility who are all telling you that it's work-related, those determinations would still be reviewed by LIRC later on, and LIRC could overrule that and say, no, that's not right.
That is correct. So there may be competing medical evidence at the hearing as to whether that treatment was related, and the employee's doctors may say it was. The employer's doctors may say it wasn't. Again, this is a very common situation. And if LIRC makes the finding that the treatment was related to the work injury, then 1M could apply if the employee undertook that treatment in good faith. So the good faith analysis comes in after that determination is made.
Counsel, I want to follow up on this hypothetical. Intersperse it with a little of the facts in this case. Assume that hypothetical. Three doctors, Mayo Clinic, all say it's work-related. And you got an IME, and they did some surgical procedure that very day. And you got an IME, an independent medical exam, 2 weeks later that said the surgery wasn't related. Would you have had any legal basis upon which to deny the claim the day of the surgery?
If after the fact it was
No, I'm talking about if let's say the patient called up and said, hey, you know, I'm going to go in for surgery later today. Is there any reason I shouldn't? Would you had any basis at that time to say, no, we won't pay for it?
As the employer's insurer, are we imagining? Because
self-insured or the employer's insurer.
I think at that point, nothing is determined. So.
That's right. So there would be nothing on the day of surgery or the day before surgery or the week before surgery that would have caused anyone to have any basis to deny the expenses for the surgery or the disability associated with the surgery. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And that didn't arise until after the expenses were incurred and after the permanent disability was encountered. Is that correct?
That's correct.
In fact, this is a scheduled injury, as I recall, a cervical fusion. And it is under the schedule of workers' compensation in your rules. I think it is a minimum permanent disability of 10%. Is that correct? Or is it more than that?
I believe so, but I don't recall from the rule.
Well, let me just say this. You acknowledge that just by the very fact that you have a cervical fusion, there is an automatic permanent partial disability rating attributed to that, automatically.
Yes.
Okay. Now,
but only if the surgery or if the injury was a pre-existing condition, because they still have to, that was related to the work injury, because there's still that determination.
My question, I was a bit more focused, but perhaps inartfully focused. Mm-hmm. I meant to inquire of the very fact that someone has a has a cervical fusion. Workers' compensation attributes the percent of disability to that cervical fusion to be a minimum of 10%.
Right? If it's a work-related injury.
Do you know, I want to come back to the hypothetical that I brought up and then Justice Ann Bradley followed up on a bit. I understand you made the comment in partial response to my question. You said, well, that's done all the time. And I agree that hindsight, these kind of questions are looked at in hindsight all the time. But the wrinkle here is we're talking about good faith, the good faith of an individual, not medically trained, presumably. And so it's not purely a question of whether the treatment provided was reasonably necessary to address the work-related injury and not the pre-existing injury. That would be something for the experts to battle out. I agree with you there. I agree. But the wrinkle here for me is the question of the patient's good faith belief in it. And how does that fit in? How do you believe that should fit into our analysis with that same set of facts, that the patient does everything that we would expect a diligent patient to do, to say, are you sure? Are you sure, doctor, that this treatment that I'm about to undergo is not related to the pre-existing? Let's imagine a highly articulate patient who is conscious of all of the laws related to workers' comp and goes through all of the questions that in hindsight seven of us would be looking at to say, did they exercise good faith? How does that fit into our analysis?
So the way that good faith would fit in under 1M is, again, as you said, you know, first there's a determination by the experts, and LURC makes the ultimate finding of whether the treatment was for a compensable injury and whether that treatment was necessary or not. If it's unnecessary, we're in 1M. Now, the good faith piece comes in, you know, after that, where the what we may look at in the record is the employee had doctor's recommendations to undergo the treatment,
right,
and relied on those recommendations in a good faith, honest belief that this treatment was necessary to treat the work injury.
You
so
have the chief of surgery at Mayo Clinic saying, yes,
right,
I've reviewed the x-rays, I've reviewed your chart, I've reviewed the record, I've consulted with your previous physician, and I'm telling you.
Yes.
Yes.
So good faith is perfectly relevant and useful in this analysis, but we need to start with the understanding and the finding that the surgery was treating the compensable work injury, and that's for the experts.
And the good faith is tied to that it was an injury at the workplace.
That it was not the good faith belief that it was necessary to treat the work injury. Yes.
Okay. So it's that there are two parts of for good faith, if I hear you right. One, that the injury is that you're being treated for is work related.
Mm-hmm.
And two, that you needed this kind of treatment.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
Now, as I understand your brief, the issue here is not medical expense.
Right.
The issue here is disability.
Yes.
Payment. Okay. So, this person might have gotten this medical treatment regardless of whether it was caused by an injury in the workplace because she wants to get better.
Mm-hmm.
So, after the fact, we're not talking really, other than in this good faith, we're not talking about whether it's related to workplace, because we're going to look at how much he's disabled, and if it's caused by injury afterwards, it's unrelated to whether he gets treatment.
If it's caused, if the injury turns out to be a compensable work injury based on the finding, then we look to see was the treatment necessary or not. If it's necessary, we're in subsection 1. If it's unnecessary.
Well, we're still talking about disability.
Right.
We're not talking about repayment for medical expenses.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Well, it's all related to, is he disabled as a result of a workplace injury, and how much?
Yes.
Counsel, is the...
that cleared.
I'm sorry, were you finished?
Yep, done. Okay.
Counsel, if the treatment turns out not to be necessary, who pays for the actual expense of the treatment?
So if the treatment, so if you're, we're assuming that we're in 1M,
yes,
and the treatment is not necessary, again, 1M does not allow recovery for medical expenses, so it would be the employee's, you know, private insurer or the worker insurer, but just not workers' compensation.
Yeah.
Yep. I see that my red light is on. If there's nothing else, I'll say thank you.
Good morning. I'm Attorney Ryan Steffes. I'm here today representing Walmart Associates, Inc. and New Hampshire Insurance Company. In light of some of the questions that have been asked by the court to this point, I'd like to start by talking a little bit about sub 1 of 10242. And it's clear, and I think everyone agrees, that under that statute, coverage under the Act is tied to whether treatment is related to the work injury, not to whether the employee has a good faith belief that it's related to the work injury. And under sub 1, that's where 99% of workers' compensation cases fall, because they're it's fairly uncommon for there to be a dispute over the necessity of the procedure. I think the workers' comp system could be structured a different way, but that's not how Wisconsin's system is structured. Coverage depends on that causal connection between the work injury and the treatment.
What are the elements of sub 2?
Sub 1M?
Sub 1M, thank you.
The employee sustains...
Excuse me, just so that I can keep this in mind. How many elements are there?
I think there are 5.
Okay, and what are they?
The employee sustains a compensable work injury. He subsequently undergoes treatment for that work injury. That's the causal connection the Court of Appeals found lacking.
Well, okay.
The surgery was generally medically acceptable, but later determined to have been medically unnecessary. And the employee had a good faith belief at the time he agreed to undergo the surgery that it was both medically necessary and related to his or her work injury.
Is that last one that you said, good faith belief, is that two things or one? Because you just gave me the employee sustained compensable injury. One, undergoes treatment for work injury. Two, medically unnecessary. Three, good faith belief. Four.
I think that last one would be two parts.
Okay.
Or the second one, I suppose, could be phrased as two parts, and this is where I think the Court of Appeals went wrong. The Court of Appeals said you simply need to have undergone invasive treatment after you've suffered the work injury. But Lurk's contention and our contention and the way Wisconsin law has been applied to this point is that there also needs to be that causal connection between the work injury and the invasive treatment the employee undergoes.
If there were a causal connection, then I have a real hard time seeing how it's unnecessary. If it's caused by the work-related injury,
right,
then why is it unnecessary?
It's medically unnecessary. So it's the circumstance, and it's the classic Spencer is, I think, the classic example of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's where the employee gets and then follows bad medical advice.
Okay. Right.
That's what makes it unnecessary.
Okay.
It's still related to the work injury because but for the work injury, the employee never would have been in the position to get and follow the bad medical advice.
But could we conclude that the work injury started this ball rolling down the hill? Because the woman didn't have a problem until she had what I think everybody concedes was a workplace injury. And because that didn't resolve, but in fact increased in regard to the concerns about her arm and her hand, does it matter that it was the workplace injury that started this ball rolling down the hill?
That comes down to a factual determination, and courts are required to defer unless there's fraud to Lurk's fact findings. In this case, Lurk's fact findings were the same as the administrative law judge's. Mrs. Pflug certainly tried to convince the administrative law judge that the symptoms that she was suffering, which was hand shaking and hand quivering,
mm-hmm,
were the result of the work injury. In that case, the surgery to treat those symptoms would have been related to the work injury. But what the ALJ found is she couldn't meet her burden to show that. And the reason the ALJ found that is he found her testimony not credible and found her expert's opinion not credible because in the ALJ's view, it was based on an inaccurate history that Ms. Pflug had given. And Lurk effectively adopted those ALJ findings, and I think those factual findings are conclusive.
But Lurk essentially found that the ALJ said there was no work-related injury, so its whole opinion is set upon a premise that's totally incorrect.
Lurk, I think, did misinterpret the underlying ALJ opinion. I think it acknowledges that. But I think, read as a whole, the Lurk opinion indicates an intent to adopt the ALJ opinion. And I think there's even a sentence in there that indicates agreement with the ALJ's findings. I interpret it to be an adoption of the ALJ's decision.
And
thank you.
What's the difference between the recovery for the worker? If I understand the argument, you're saying this medical treatment, which caused even greater problems for her, right?
The treatment in this case, I think, was actually successful.
Okay.
It relieved her symptoms.
All right. So it relieved her symptoms. So what are we fighting about?
We're fighting about whether my client, the workers' comp insurer,
yeah,
has liability for the disability indemnity resulting from that procedure.
But you said it improved it, and we're talking about disability. So I don't understand what that problem is. It seems to me she would be entitled, assuming it was an initially work-related injury, she would be entitled to disability compensation from your client. Now, if she got it improved and it went away, and we're not talking about medical expenses then, and she's now 100% terrific, why is she getting any disability? That's why I ask the question.
I think this goes back to Justice Ann Walsh Bradley's point that this is the cervical fusion is a scheduled procedure that's assigned a minimum amount of permanent partial disability.
Regardless of the actual disability.
Correct. That's my understanding.
So how do you eliminate that in your argument?
Well, you never get to that question because there's a threshold issue, which is that did she undergo the surgery because of the work injury? Is there that causal connection? And is it required under the statute, like it's required under sub 1 of the statute? And
you agree there's a compensable injury. Is that correct?
Correct. Our position has always been that she suffered a neck strain.
And that you paid temporary total disability. You paid disability benefits for a period of time.
Right.
Indemnity for missed work, I believe. Paid.
Temporary.
Yeah. Temporary correct. Total disability.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
One of the things when we review the decision of LIRC is did they act within their powers? How can we say they acted within their powers when the LIRC decision was the applicant has failed to establish a sustainable compensable injury?
Again, my interpretation of the LIRC decision would be that it is intended to be and effectively an adoption of the ALJ decision and the findings of fact therein.
Okay. How can we give deference as a result of this conclusion that there wasn't any compensable injury and based the LIRC decision went on to say, look, there was different history given and therefore and there was conflated terminology in the history and therefore no compensable injury. That's what the LIRC decision went on to say. That is the two paragraphs that finished this decision explained why there was no compensable injury and didn't get to interpretation of 1M. So how can we give deference to a non-existent interpretation?
Well, the interpretation has since been set forth by LIRC in briefing before this court. Interestingly, what 102.42.1M meant wasn't briefed before the Court of Appeals because the parties agreed as to what the statute meant. Their dispute was very much a factual one as to what my client's expert had actually opined. So LIRC first set forth that interpretation in its briefing to this court.
Counsel, may I just ask?
I see my time is expired.
Most decisions that we have in our standard of review section emphasize that our job here is to review the decision of what would here be LIRC. That's our job. We don't look at the ALJ. You know, our review is there. How can we sustain a decision that makes a conclusion that the applicant failed to sustain a compensable injury and then follows that conclusion with two relatively lengthy paragraphs sustaining that conclusion and that's it and never gives an interpretation? How can we sustain this LIRC ruling when there's a non-existent interpretation and before the Court of Appeals, concededly before the Court of Appeals, the counsel for the state, conceded that this was wrong. That's my understanding.
And again, I think I get back to the point that LIRC did set forth its interpretation ultimately now before this court. And that interpretation, perhaps most importantly, has been out there a long time because it's the interpretation of the City of Wauwatosa case and the Spencer case. And in our brief, we cited numerous LURC opinions where they explain and apply the holdings of those cases. Everyone agrees sub 1M, with one exception that doesn't come into play in this case, is a codification of that pre-existing law. So LURC's interpretation follows right from its understanding of those cases to 102.42.1M, and it sets forth that same interpretation in this case. And it has acknowledged its misreading of the ALJ's decision, but I think would agree with me that it was adopting the ALJ's decision despite that one misstatement of what the ALJ found.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. Our statute, 102.42.1M, applies only when there is a compensable injury. A compensable injury either undisputed or a compensable injury as found by an administrative law judge.
Can I talk to you a little bit about compensable injury? I kind of wanted to ask some questions over there, but there wasn't room to jump in. So I just need to separate this out and try to simplify it for me. There can be a compensable injury that is work-related, but would not result in 10% loss and workers' comp going forward. There can be compensable injury. Let me try it differently. If someone has arthritis and they have a work-related injury, if the arthritis is the cause of the disability, that's not necessarily an issue for workers' comp, right?
Correct.
If the neck strain, because I lifted a box, is the cause of a compensable injury, I should be compensated for that neck strain, and my bills should be paid for that neck strain, right?
Correct.
But if I also happen to have arthritis, I don't receive compensation for my arthritis, right?
Under certain circumstances, if the injury aggravates that arthritis beyond normal progression.
Okay. So in this case, she undertook medical procedures and steps to treat the neck strain that was work-related, right? Everyone agrees to that.
Correct.
The parties kind of part ways here with the surgery and the 10% loss that would forever be associated with that surgery, right?
Correct.
So the issue that I hear some of my colleagues talking about is, did she undertake the surgery in good faith? Is there a question with respect to whether she did it in good faith? How would somebody know whether they're doing that in good faith? And why shouldn't Walmart have to pay for that? Because she did all this thinking she was treating her neck strain from her injury at Walmart. Okay? So I hear that. And then I hear this analysis about if it's not a compensable injury, we don't owe the workers' comp. Can you tie those together so it makes a little more sense?
Yes. And if I may be specific to Ms. Pflug. Ms. Pflug had the onset of symptoms while at work and believed she was treating for a work injury. Her doctors believed she was treating for a work injury and offered her surgery to correct the symptoms. At the time she underwent surgery, It was undisputed that she had a compensable injury. It was only after she had surgery when Walmart began to dispute the compensability of that surgery. Sent her a letter, said, hey, our doctor said your condition or your surgery is unrelated to the work injury. That particular construct is a challenge to Ms. Pflug's treatment providers. It's telling them, hey, we know that you guys believe this is related to the work injury, but we're arguing it's not. And going back before 102.42.1M.
Counsel, before you go there, you acknowledge that the surgery was not necessary to treat the work injury, correct?
No.
Do you acknowledge that the ALJ found that the surgery was not necessary
yes.
to treat? Okay. So that's what we're going to be working with here. Right?
Okay.
So we've got that as a foundation. Was this surgery necessary or unnecessary?
I believe it was necessary. The judge found it was unnecessary. And either way,
okay,
Ms. Pflug underwent that treatment in good faith, believing it was related to her work injury.
So don't you need to believe that the surgery is unnecessary so you can fit within 1M?
Yes, I do for purposes of argument. Correct.
Well, I hope you're going to be consistent, right, throughout your case. This is okay. either a necessary surgery or it's unnecessary. Which is
unnecessary as determined by the administrative law judge.
Okay, but you're saying it's necessary.
Always have.
Okay. And if it's necessary, aren't you conceding that this does not fit within 1M?
I would argue if the judge found it was necessary, it would fit within sub 1.
If it would be but that would be necessary to treat the work injury.
Correct.
So if it's necessary to treat an injury that's not a work injury, then it would not fall under sub 1.
I'm sorry, I didn't really understand that question.
I might have had too many negatives in there.
No.
So let's say the surgery is necessary, but it's necessary to treat an injury that was not sustained at work. Right?
Okay.
Let's assume that. There's going to be no compensation under sub 1 for that, correct?
Actually, under Spencer, I think there is.
Wait. Well, Spencer dealt with unnecessary treatments for work-related injuries, right?
Spencer dealt with the employee's good faith reliance on...
Right. Before we get to the good faith... As a structural matter, Spencer dealt with treatments that were unnecessary to treat the workplace injury, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So under 1M, we're not talking about, or I'm sorry, under 1, we're not talking about Spencer. Under 1, we're just talking about whether there is a workplace injury and whether you get compensation for necessary treatment, right?
Correct.
That's 1. All right. So if a treatment is necessary for a non-workplace injury, you're not going to get compensated under 1, correct?
Correct.
So the question then is, if it is necessary to treat a condition that she has, can it also be unnecessary so that she can get disability benefits under 1L? Is that what you're saying?
Trying to follow your question. I'm not trying to avoid it. I'm just trying to understand it.
Let me give it another shot here. So we say that as a medical matter, it's necessary, right? And in fact, it actually did treat her condition and cured her, right?
It did.
Okay. So in that sense, it was necessary. So now we go to 1M, and now you say, but for purposes of disability benefits, it's unnecessary. So how can it be both?
It can be both because the judge found the treatment was unnecessary.
He found that it was unnecessary for the workplace injury.
Correct.
So your position then is that Ms. Flug should be compensated for treatments that are unnecessary to workplace injuries.
Yes, that's exactly what the statute reads.
Now, then does she also get compensated for treatments that were necessary for a non-workplace injury?
No, because she wouldn't have a workers' compensation claim.
Well, isn't that the case here? I mean, and I understand you disagree with whether or not the treatment was related to the workplace injury, but the ALJ decided that it was not, right? So no. Ms. Flug is in the position of asking for disability benefits for a treatment that was necessary to a non-workplace injury.
The judge did not find that the treatment was necessary for a non-work-related condition, and neither did Dr. Soriano, Walmart's attorney. What the judge found was that Ms. Flug failed to prove entitlement to additional disability benefits related to the surgery.
Yes, but he found that because he found that this treatment was not for a workplace injury. It was treatment for a non-workplace injury.
I don't believe he found that, Justice Kelly.
What do you believe he found with respect to whether this was a workplace injury or not?
He found, the judge found, that Ms. Flug failed.
The ALJ judge you're talking
yes.
about.
Yes, I'm sorry, Justice Brennan. The ALJ found that Ms. Flug failed to meet her burden of proving entitlement to benefits beyond that already conceded and paid by Walmart.
But she failed because?
Because she was arguing that that treatment was necessary due to the work injury. And by making that particular finding, the judge implicitly found that the treatment was unnecessary for the work injury. Even though he didn't explicitly say the treatment was unnecessary for the work injury, he was dealing with a claim in which Ms. Flug was arguing, hey, I underwent treatment necessary for my work injury. The judge said, sorry, you didn't prove that beyond a legitimate doubt. And the implicit finding there is that the treatment was unnecessary for the work injury.
Unless the treatment is unnecessary for the work injury, you can't come within 1M, can you?
Correct.
I understand your argument to be, as you advanced at the hearing, this is a compensable injury, and the disability is as a result of an aggravation that of a pre-existing condition that aggravated it beyond its normal progression, for which that's compensable under workers' comp. You either have, if you have a pre-existing condition, if the aggravation exacerbated it beyond normal progression, it's still compensable. And you had your doctors testify to, or with their form, present that. Seems to me that that's your position, that as I hear your responses to Justice Kelly, that's your position. But you're here with an alternative because you have to deal with the cards that are dealt you right now. And the cards that are dealt you is that there's a finding below, or there's something below, of a lurk that it's not necessary. I use finding loosely. A determination of non-compensability, let's say. And so that's the cards you're playing right now, because that's the deck that's been set. You've always believed that it's compensable, but now you have to argue the alternative. But let me ask, does it really make any difference to you if it's necessary or unnecessary, if it was done in good faith?
No, it does not. Because if it is unnecessary, it's compensable under 1M. And if it was necessary, it's compensable under sub 1.
Okay, now we're maybe back to my question. I'd like to bring you back there then. Under 1, I mean, the purpose of workers' comp is to compensate for work-related injury, right?
Correct.
It is not to compensate for something that's not work-related. Let's just say, let's just assume arthritis not work-related under this scenario. I should receive compensation for a neck strain that's work-related, but should I receive compensation for arthritis if it's not work-related?
No, because your arthritis claim is not a compensable injury claim.
Okay. When you read one, you receive compensation for, it just instead of compensable injury, put in work-related injury.
Okay.
Okay. Under one, do you receive compensation for arthritis?
If you've aggravated that arthritis, yes.
Okay.
But if you haven't aggravated it, so it is not a work-related injury, then no.
Okay. And if I have a work-related, if I read 1M and instead of compensable injury, I put in work-related injury. If an employee who has sustained a work-related injury undertakes in good faith treatment that's medically acceptable but unnecessary, does the unnecessary tie back to the work-related injury, or is unnecessary just generally unnecessary?
No, it is generally unnecessary because the word unnecessary isn't qualified in that statute. In fact, when the statute was created...
So if I have any surgery, so long as I've had some work-related injury, I can have any surgery and receive workers' comp benefits for anything that happens to me because of that surgery. Whatever disability that causes, I receive that.
Not any surgery.
Well, what's it have to be related to if it doesn't have to be related to the work-related injury?
It has to be related to the condition for which you were seeking treatment. If Ms. Fluke had an injury to her neck, which she did, she couldn't go in and then say, please cover my knee-related surgery.
What if a doctor said that her knee-related surgery, just going on with this hypothetical, actually was related to the work injury because she injured her neck or shoulder and that caused her to move differently and affected her knee, and she was overusing her knee or using it in a different way, and he could tie it back. We have a doctor saying, I can tie that back to the work injury. Compensable?
It is compensable. That's an altered gait theory, and if you can demonstrate that the work injury was a substantial factor in causing the secondary disability, that would be a compensable injury.
But here we have the finder of fact determining, based on an examination of all the medical records and looking at differing medical opinions and making a credibility determination as to which was accurate.
Yes, at hearing, in that situation, the respondents would deny a compensable injury to the knee. And a judge would have to determine whether that person sustained a compensable injury to the knee. Once a judge determines that there's a compensable injury, then if the injured employee underwent treatment, knee surgery, in good faith, it would be compensable.
But you're mixing up one and two. Two relates to when it's unnecessary to the compensable injury. One relates when it's necessary to the compensable injury. I hear you arguing, hey, altered gait is necessary to the compensable injury. That fall under one.
Okay. I think Spencer dealt with that, Justice Ziegler, because in Spencer, which was before 1M was ever created, the only statute was number one. And in Spencer, this court determined that if the injured employee underwent treatment in good faith, even though that treatment was unnecessary, it would be compensable under number one.
But in Spencer, there was no dispute that the injury in question was work-related. Here, we have that dispute, so I don't think Spencer is dispositive.
In Spencer, it was a compensable injury, and the dispute was over the extent of treatment for that compensable injury.
Right, that's not the case. This case is more like City of Wauwatosa, isn't it?
No.
Well, in the city of Wauwatosa, there was a dispute about whether the treatment was directed at a workplace injury as opposed to a non-workplace injury. And based on the ALJ's determination, that's what we have here, right? We're looking at whether this surgery was related to a workplace injury or pre-existing condition.
Wauwatosa, the dispute was whether there was a compensable injury for which the employee underwent surgery. It wasn't an agreement that there was a compensable injury and then a dispute over the extent of treatment. For instance, in Wauwatosa, the respondents always argued that the injured employee, well, that the employee did not sustain a compensable injury to his hip that necessitated the surgery. The treating doctor said, yes, he sustained a compensable injury to the hip that required the surgery.
But there, I want to make sure you had the facts straight on Sudhi Wauwatosa.
Okay.
There was a finding that there was a compensable injury. He did fall. He did injure his hip. The question was whether the surgery was necessary to address that injury.
That is what the circuit court found, yes. But I think the Court of Appeals in Wauwatosa said Spencer doesn't apply.
Right. It said Spencer did not apply because the surgery did not relate to the workplace injury. It related to the pre-existing condition.
I just read it differently. With all due respect, I'm just not following, because my understanding was Wauwatosa, the man stepped off a curb. He had dysplastic hips. His doctor said that as a result of stepping off the curb, he aggravated those dysplastic hips beyond normal progression and needed a surgery. Insurance company doctor comes in and says he didn't injure his dysplastic hips. And that case went before hearing, and ultimately it was determined that, yes, indeed, he sustained an injury to his dysplastic hips, and that necessitated the surgery.
Let me read you a passage from City of Wauwatosa.
Okay.
It says, in Spencer, it was undisputed that the injury was a compensable industrial injury. Here, however, there was a dispute in the medical testimony about whether the employee's condition for which surgery was performed was even related to the compensable industrial injury. The hearing examiner found that the compensable industrial injury, so there was a compensable industrial injury, did not necessitate surgery.
Because the hearing examiner in that case found that the compensable industrial injury was something else.
Right. So we have a question of whether we have a compensable injury and a pre-existing condition. And City of Wauwatosa said the surgery related to the pre-existing condition, not the compensable industrial injury, and therefore, no benefits.
In Wauwatosa?
Yes.
In Pflug, the independent medical examiner said
Was City of Wauwatosa wrong?
I'm sorry?
Was City of Wauwatosa wrong?
No, City of Wauwatosa wasn't wrong. It just doesn't apply because it wasn't the dispute over the extent of treatment for the compensable injury.
And that's not the dispute here, is it? The dispute is whether the surgery in this case related to a workplace injury or a pre-existing condition.
The dispute here is whether the employee who sustained a compensable injury underwent the surgery in good faith.
That's step two. Let's stick with step one.
Okay.
Right? Step one is we're trying to figure out whether this is like City of Wauwatosa, where the question was, did the surgery relate to the compensable workplace injury or a pre-existing condition? Here we have to figure that out too, right? We have to figure out, does the surgery she underwent relate to the compensable injury or a pre-existing condition? And then we'll deal with good faith after that.
Well, you're getting to the question, I believe, as to whether the surgery was unnecessary. To argue that the surgery is unrelated is simply a portion of the unnecessary surgery phrase. Let me see if I can put this differently. If the respondents argue that the surgery is unrelated to the work injury, what they're arguing is it is unrelated to cure and relieve from the effects of injury. It is unnecessary to cure and relieve from the effects of injury. It's unrelated because it's unnecessary to cure and relieve from the effects of injury. By arguing it's unrelated, it's just a subset of what unnecessary surgeries can be. When the legislature enacted 102.42.1M, it was aware of the Court of Appeals decision in Hahnthanners. And in Hahnthanners, the employer argued that at some point, treatment for the work injury ended, and continuing treatment was unrelated to the work injury.
Well,
the commission rejected that in Hahnthanners and reversed its position here.
He argued it was unnecessary, right? So the question was, at some point in Hahnthanners, the condition became resolved, treatment continued, and the question was whether that treatment after the resolution of the condition was necessary or unnecessary and what effect that would have for compensation. So that was an extent of treatment question, but there was no dispute about whether it was directed at treating a compensable injury, right?
Yes, the respondents in Hahnthanners argued that the excessive treatment was unrelated to the compensable injury.
Well, no, they argued it was unnecessary because the condition had resolved itself, right? So they didn't point to some other condition the person had and said the treatment was related to that other condition. Everybody understood the treatment was still supposed to be directed at the compensable injury.
Correct. And I think we have the same situation here, Justice Kelly. Why? Because the insurance company doctor never said the surgery was for a pre-existing condition. The insurance company doctor said the surgery was performed because of subjective complaints by Ms. Fluke. The surgery was performed for a strain, the very strain that he diagnosed. Specifically, the independent medical examiner looked at things and said, wait, there's no objective evidence on film. There's no objective findings that require surgery. And if you look at the operative report, there was nothing objective in there. So the insurance company doctor said, hey, this surgery was unrelated to the work injury because it was unnecessary to cure and relieve her from the effects of a strain, which he found, even though he did say she had the surgery for the strain.
Well, according to the Court of Appeals, he didn't think that the Flug's original complaints had anything to do with the workplace.
I'm sorry, just Saberton.
Paragraph 29 in the Court of Appeals decision.
Yes.
Seems to say that Soriano didn't think anything she had, or he had, Mr. Fluke had anything to do with workplace injury. That's what paragraph 29 seems to say. Soriano further opined the nature of Fluke's work could not have caused the symptoms she reported. As a result, he concluded that the treatment Flug underwent was unrelated to the work incident or work exposure.
Except the judge found that there was a compensable injury.
Okay, but that's not what Soriano seemed to say.
Well,
do you think that's wrong in this Court of Appeals decision?
Justice Abramson, can I grab my copy of that, please?
You can grab anything you want within reason.
You don't have this memorized verbatim.
And that is.
And I'll tell you what my next question is going to be. Is there anything else in the Court of Appeals decision you think is wrong or erroneous?
The paragraph,
29, page 14 of the red brief. That's where I'm looking. In the Court of Appeals decision.
Okay. Dr. Soriano opined the only injury Fluke sustained was a soft tissue cervical and shoulder strain.
Right.
Okay.
The condition wasn't aggravated or exacerbated by the incident in question, and it had no relationship to the degenerative changes. Further opined that the nature of the work couldn't have caused the symptoms she reported. I don't know what all that means. If it doesn't mean it's not related, even the Walmart thinks it is.
Dr. Soriano admits there that Ms. Fluke sustained an injury. And getting back to an earlier question from Justice Ann Bradley here, it wasn't our only position at the hearing that Ms. Fluke sustained an injury that necessitated surgery, but that if Soriano was correct and the surgery was unnecessary, we should have recovered under sub 1M.
Yeah, okay.
So either way, go with Dr. Soriano, go with the treating physicians. Necessary or unnecessary, Ms. Fluke should have been awarded the limited workers' comp benefit she can receive. Because she underwent the treatment in good faith.
Do you agree with paragraph 28 in the Court of Appeals? Commission concedes Fluge sustained a compensable injury, namely the strain. Therefore, its conclusion that 1M doesn't apply because she didn't sustain a compensable injury is incorrect. In recognition of this error, the Commission advances an alternative argument raised for the first time in the Circuit Court. The Commission contends the statute allows an employee who sustained a compensable injury, that's the strain, to recover compensation for all disability incurred as a result of medically acceptable treatment that is undertaken in good faith as a result of the compensable injury, even if the injury was unnecessary. That's the Commission's position. In other words, Commission focuses on causation, arguing an employee must show that a compensable injury caused the invasive treatment.
Do I agree with the Commission's decision?
No.
Or
but this is a their statement of the Commission's position. The Court of Appeals ultimately says no deal, not accepting that, because under paragraph 30, the Commission is reading an additional causation requirement into the statute.
Yes, I agree with that Court of Appeals opinion.
All right. Anything
I think you asked earlier, Justice Abrams, whether
disagree?
I agree with.
Anything
I,
you disagree? Anything
I don't
you
disagree
exchange?
With the Court of Appeals opinion at all.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry.
Can I try one final time? If we had only neck strain, no arthritis, and I'm using that term because it's understandable to me. If she had the surgery and it was deemed to be necessary because of the neck strain, it'd be covered under one, right?
Necessary to treat the work neck strain.
There's nothing
yep.
else. It's
yep.
only the neck strain.
Yes.
The neck strain's work-related. Okay?
Yep.
If she had the surgery because she thought it helped the neck strain, but it was determined the surgery was unnecessary, it would still be covered, but it'd be covered under 1M.
Again, if there's no pre-existing condition we're
nothing
thinking about.
Nothing else, just the work-related neck strain.
If right? the other elements of the statute are met.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
I have just
what,
a few. Oh, go
what
ahead.
What we have here seems to be we have a neck strain, And the argument, as it unfolds, is certainly a neck strain. And the question is, medically, I'm not sure it's a question for us because we're not doctors, but the question was medically whether or not the compensable injury on a February 14th or whenever it was, one that's conceded. Mm-hmm. And I think what's not conceded is the nature and extent of the injury. By that, I mean that it is your position that the February 14th did not aggravate beyond normal progression a progressively deteriorating disease known as arthritis to some of us. And it is your opposing counsel's position that it did aggravate beyond normal progression. I mean, certainly arthritis is there, and the question is whether or not it aggravated beyond normal progression, because if it did, then it's then you're on the hook. Let's use that term.
Very important, because I want to emphasize that Lurk made a conclusive finding that was not appealed and was upheld by the Court of Appeals that this injury was temporary in nature and it healed well before the surgery occurred, and it did not aggravate the pre-existing condition. That finding is conclusive in the record, and that is the world we are operating within. So that's really important. Whether we're debating about what the expert said, that's already been done.
Well,
Lurk has already
made
that finding.
No, I have not genuflected at the altar of this particular order, because it says the applicant has failed to sustain a compensable injury, and everyone concedes now that that statement is incorrect.
Yes.
And as I indicated before, then the rest of the order all goes to substantiate that incorrect statement.
So we acknowledged in our brief that there was imprecision in the way that Lurk characterized what the ALJ found, but Lurk, as my co-appellant said, also adopted the ALJ's findings and conclusions of its own, provided a very developed argument consistent with past Lurk decisions on the proper interpretation of 1M, and that's what this Court is here to decide today. The findings themselves should not be in dispute because they were conclusively found. There is a section at the back of our opening brief explaining why those findings are supported by evidence.
But am I correct with regard to what's really in dispute here? I mean, everyone agrees there was a compensable injury that occurred, I think, on February 14th. I might have the date wrong.
You do have the date right, 2013.
Okay. Everyone agrees there's a compensable injury.
Yes.
And everyone agrees that if that compensable injury exacerbated an underlying condition beyond normal progression, you're on the hook for it all.
Yes.
And what's in dispute is, medically, is whether or not it was exacerbated beyond normal progression. And if you can say, no, the healing period ended, as you do, before the surgery, then you're not on the hook for it. And
the analysis correct, but the position of the state is that those fact findings have already been done. And so what we're really talking about here is the proper interpretation of 1M. And my red light is on, so I'll just conclude that we do not agree that the word unnecessary is synonymous with unrelated. Based on the plain language reading of the statute with subsection 1, the Court of Appeals decision should be reversed. Thank you very much.
Thank you both for a very good argument. I don't know that the Court has looked at 1M, and so it's really nice of you to bring it to us, and hopefully we can lend some clarity to it with our decision. The briefs were very good, and the argument was quite good on all sides, so thank you. We are now going to take an adjournment for a few minutes while the next case takes the position at council table. Thank you.